They're coming to get you, Barbara. They're coming for you, Barbara.
What an excellent day for exorcism.
Did you know that you are talking to an artist?
I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it!
People like to have a hell of a time, don't they?
What's up, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. And we're doing a bit of a double header thing today. I had some family medical things I had to take care of, and then some personal medical things that I had to take care of, because in the process of finding someone to deal with like my dogs and some other things, I tripped in a pothole and sprained my ankle. So I've been a very busy person for the past 24 hours or so, going hither and thither and yon and dealing with house fires and whatnot. So this is the first of two, maybe three episodes that I'm going to record in one session here, and bang out the whole week kind of in one session if I can. And today's episode's sort of interesting for me because as a young person who was taking an interest in, you know, paranormal things, supernatural things, cult leaders, serial killers, aliens, devil worship, you know, the usual stuff, werewolves were really kind of one of my first personal interests as far as, you know, supernatural things and cryptids are concerned. I was never really into vampires all that much, to be honest. I'm still not. You know, my interest in death metal has me taking vacations in zombie land every once in a while, but that's never really been my major thing unless I'm trying to look at gory stuff. Werewolves, for some reason, resonated with me much more than a lot of the other cryptids, monsters, creatures, and weird things in that whole milieu of stuff. So I think, really, even before I had an interest in aliens, werewolves kind of fascinated me. Not because I wasn't sure if they were a real thing or not, just the idea of what convinced people that there were people that turned into animals, and even more than that, what convinced some people that that's a thing they could do. And of course, we've all seen the documentaries about medical lycanthropism and the whole medical condition of growing excessive amounts of hair all over your body, and that family, and I believe it was France, that worked as acrobats for a circus for a few years. We're not going to talk about that today because that's a medical condition and this is spooky season, so fuck that. If everything could be explained as easily as, well, there was a medical condition for that, this would be a boring show, wouldn't it? So we're going to kind of push that stuff to the side and focus on what most people are tuning into this show for, the supernatural, and of course, Nazis. So those things are going to come up today, and of course, as has become something of a season three tradition, in the way that if I were to say that every season has like a main villain, right? And the pilot season is kind of a gimme in that it's basically the FBI. Season two, I think Helena Blavatsky sort of works as a through line through most of what we cover in season two, tying a lot of the ideas and concepts together. And in much the same way, in season three, Pliny the Elder comes up over and over and over again as a source of, well, how far back does this go? Oh, you made it up. That's interesting. So there's a lot of cases this season in particular where you know, we've talked about sorcery, necromancy, black magic, the druids, and a lot of those things. And you can trace a lot of that shit back to this cat. And while there's multiple sources that you can trace werewolves to, and honestly, the concept of, like, people turning into animals kind of exists on every continent in the world in some form or fashion, and we'll talk about that too, but this is another thing where the Western conception of, like, fucking lycanthropy traces, again, from the ancient Greco-Roman tradition to the medieval church, and then got weird whenever, like, New Age people got a handle on it, and then it got kind of racist. It's sort of like everything else that filters through this same kind of a cycle that you don't realize how prevalent that is until you really start looking at it, and then you're like, oh, fuck, so this just happened over and over and over and over again. But today's not going to be any different. I'm sorry. There's some interesting things and, some conversation about the evolution of the perception of the werewolf that I think, may be socially relevant and prudent. If you're hoping to get away from all of the news about anti-Semitism suddenly becoming en vogue all over again, I apologize, because one of the things I think you're going to find is that there's a lot of possible ties to anti-Semitism and werewolf lore. I don't know what to tell you about the fact that all of a sudden, like, there's tons of famous people saying things about the Jews on television. That's not something specifically that I had on the card, but it is an election year, and that is kind of a major component of the right wing now. So I guess it's sort of to be expected, but it is just kind of weird every day as a person who studies what I study and does what I do to, like, look at the news and be like, oh, wow, okay. So that's just the protocols of the Elders of Zion, huh? Donald Trump said that Jews needed to watch themselves and be careful what they have. Huh. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So it's been weird, especially with how much of the history of that we've covered this season, with blood libel and the reptilian conspiracy, and of course the Turner Diaries. And we're going to get into it a bit more as the season goes on. And our ongoing continued foray into bits and pieces of history about the Nazi Party. So it's been interesting to see a lot of what we've talked about on the show mirrored on today's newspapers. And that's been fucking weird. I don't really know how to reconcile that other than, I don't know, maybe buy a gun and a whole bunch of water. Sorry for bumming everybody out, but now seems like the perfect place, based on my business acumen, to put an ad plug. So if you enjoy Come and See, and you'd like to become a member of the Hep Cult, and sign up for our subscription service at Patreon, you can do so at www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. There's a few different reward tier options available for you there, where you can subscribe to the show and help me pay bills and things of that nature. I don't know why I chose that to be the place where I put that. I guess I'm just intentionally really, really bad at promoting this. But the meat of the show remains the important part, I think. And you know, if you build it, they will come, or whatever Bjork said. Anyway, on with the program. Here we go. So, In a way, it's sort of ironic that I said that I grew up really liking werewolves, because werewolves are basically shapeshifters who transform from human form into some variation of wolf, wolf man, man wolf, wolf creature, or you get the fucking idea. Werewolves are possibly the most well-known of what are called therianthropes, humans who can shapeshift into animals or animal hybrids. Therianthropy has been tracked back to cave drawings found in the Pyrenees in France. Werewolves are a form of therianthrope called lycanthropes, and they appear primarily in Europe and European folklore. Analogues, such as the werehyena in Africa and the werehound in India, really demonstrate that the idea is somewhat regional. Like many of the subjects we've discussed on the show, the Greeks may have introduced the idea of werewolves, and it was refined by the medieval church in parallel with witchcraft. Werewolf trials, along with witch trials, really emerged in Valais in the 15th century and peaked during the 17th century in Europe. In 1589, the serial killer and cannibal, well, maybe, Peter Stump was discovered in 1920 by an occultist named Montague Summers, who reprinted the pamphlet about Stump in his book, The Werewolf. Stump was a German farmer who had been so named because his left hand had been cut off. Cute. The werewolf who was supposedly terrorizing the town of Bedburg was also missing its left hand. After accusations that he had sucked the blood out of sheep, goats, and people, and had been having sex with his daughter, Stump was arrested and tortured. After being tortured, he admitted to having practiced black magic since the age of 12. He also said that the devil had given him a magic belt that allowed him to turn into, quote, the likeness of a greedy, devouring wolf. When he took the belt off, he turned back into a man. It's probably noteworthy that no such belt was ever found or accounted for, and that the guy who said he had it was on a torture rack at the time, but, you know, whatever. Stump, again, under pain of torture, confessed to killing and eating 14 children, 2 pregnant women, and both of their fetuses. Stump also allegedly killed and ate his own children. According to the pamphlet, Stump, his daughter, and his mistress were all executed on October 31st, 1589. I'm gonna trigger warning the next bit before I describe the execution. It's actually pretty fucking graphic. So, trigger warning for like the next 10 to 15 seconds. Stump was tied to a wheel. Red-hot pincers tore the flesh from his body, and then his legs were broken with a shovel, and he was beheaded before the remains were burned. Apparently, if you didn't break a werewolf's legs, it would come back to life. Stump's mistress and daughter were then flayed alive and strangled. The town then erected a torture rack and put Stump's head on top of it as a warning against werewolfery. People before television had really, really, really vivid imaginations for this kind of stuff. And, you know, I guess It's kind of apparent when you watch reality TV that the tendency for unique and sensational ways to humiliate and hurt complete strangers is just kind of a component of human entertainment for some reason. At least in the West, that seems to be a thing. Not necessarily a good thing, but definitely a thing. This began a trend, this case of Peter Stump, in Christendom, of werewolf accusations that were very much like blood libel linked to the death or disappearance of children for the next 200 years. But before the medieval period, werewolves had again, like I said, been mentioned by the ancient Greeks. Herodotus's histories mentions the Neuri, or Neuri, in the 5th century BC. The Neuri lived in what would today be Poland or Belarus, and they had been driven further down river from their land of origin by a plague of snakes. And every year, all of the Neuri transformed into wolves for several days. Now, what's interesting is, given similarities between accusations of werewolfery and blood libel, several historians, including Olaf von Dahlen, trace the Neuri genetically to be Semitic, meaning these 3rd century werewolves were Jews, albeit a group that had intermingled with the Scythians and the Levantines of the region, but still Jews. So there appears to be something of a link between werewolves historically and Jewish persecution, from what I can gather, because a lot of the reports of werewolf attacks sound exactly like blood libel accusations. There's also the story of King Lycan of Arcadia, which was first related by the Greek geographer Pausanias. Lycan was the son of one of the Oceanids, who we discussed back in the mermaid episode, and he was married to a nymph, apparently. Lycan founded the Lycosaura, which was an ancient city that worshipped a version of one of the daughters of Poseidon, and is sort of one of the earliest recorded mystery schools, as the name of the goddess that they worshipped, who they called the Mistress, was only revealed to those who were initiated into the cult. Lycan was turned into a wolf after angering Zeus by killing his own son and feeding the meat to Zeus. Zeus then brought the boy, whose name was Nyctimus, back to life and cursed the king to live in wolf form. Werewolves are often associated with curses, even before the conflation with witchcraft, actually. And this story of the king cursed to live as a wolf also appears in Ovid's Metamorphoses. In this version, Lycan wishes to test the divinity of Zeus, and so he serves him slave entrails to see if he'll be able to tell the difference. And then, because he can, Zeus, in disgust, transforms the king into a wolf. In a weird spin-off of this, another man from Arcadia who eats the entrails, whose name is Demarchus of Parasia, also transforms into a wolf. That story is told by both Pausanias and Pliny the Elder. Pausanias actually marks lycanthropy as something of an Arcadian cultural tradition since the time of Lycan, and that the men of Arcadia all must spend 9 years living as wolves, and they may only return to human form if they do not consume human flesh while living as wolves. And, okay, so, first diversion of the episode, I guess. There's there's really problematic undertones historically concerning the subject of cannibalism. Despite the prevalence of claims by colonizers, the Greeks, and the church, it's really nowhere near as prevalent as it's made out to be. Typically, cannibalism was one of many accusations that were lobbied at groups to present them as savage or uncivilized. For example, island dwellers, Africans, the ancient Celts, and the Jews have all variously been accused of cannibalism and similar animal-like behavior. We discussed a little bit of that with the ancient Celts episode. The racial overtones of particularly modern werewolf depictions are suspect, to say the least, but we'll get into that a bit later in the episode. As such, usual suspects for state literary propaganda, like Pliny the Elder, have numerous stories about people who transform into wolves and eat other fucking people. He and Ovid talk about the Wolfman of Arcadia in several different stories and spin yarns of giant wolf people roaming the countrysides there. And these stories are, like those of demons and druids and witchcraft, expounded upon later by the medieval church. Several of Pliny's Wolfman stories are actually retold in the book The City of God by Augustine of Hippo, who adds to the stories the link between lycanthropy and witchcraft. There are also possible links, this is kind of interesting to me, to stories about werewolves and the berserkers. So, berserkers, kind of like druids, might not have been a real thing, but if they were, they were associated with hunting magic that was practiced by three primary animal cults: the bear, the boar, and the wolf. There are relief paintings of Trajan's conquest of Dacia in 106 AD that depict barefoot warriors in bear and wolf skins. And there's no further reference to these men after this battle in 106 AD until 700 years later in 872 AD and the Battle of Hafrsfjord, where they're mentioned as fighting on behalf of King Harald Fairhair, which has to be the greatest name I've ever heard for a person who's supposed to be a real person. There's plates in addition to this that were discovered in 1870, gold plates that have carvings on them that may depict what could be described as a berserker ritual. The Norse wolf warriors wore what were called wolf coats or ulfhednar. They appear in legends from the Turks, the Mongols, and the Indo-Europeans, actually. They're described as King Fairhair's elite soldiers, berserkers who wore wolf pelts over their chainmail so fierce that they became wolves at night in some accounts. One such account is of a man named Kveldulf, or the Eve Wolf, who wore no chainmail into battle at all and felt no pain. That's what going berserk is, technically. It's like rage beyond pain. Some have suggested drugs or magic potions were used to achieve this state of mind. The Nazis tried meth, but we'll get to them later. In some depictions, the Berserkers are like Odin's elite force, actually, incapable of feeling pain and assuming a bestial countenance. The Berserker was later recontextualized by the church as a heathen in the thrall of the devil, wolf-skinned men who drank blood and murdered indiscriminately, savages, again with the wolf propaganda. The Berserker Rage, or as it was called, Berserker's Gong, is described as seizing these men, sort of endowing them with inhuman strength and durability. It kind of makes me think of the Incredible Hulk. It's described as beginning with shivering, teeth chattering, and the chills, and then their faces would swell up and become hot, creating an uncontrollable rage that would make the men bite their own shields, howl like animals, and attack their own allies on the field. This state of mind could last for days, apparently, and you wonder what they fucking did with them once the battles were over. Did some of them just, like, become the wild men of the woods like we talked about on the Merlin episode? Is that just what happened? You went nuts, you killed a whole bunch of people, and then just kind of wandered off into the woods because you'd gone out a little bit too far to reintegrate into society? Also, with all of the descriptions of getting the chills and teeth chattering and then getting really hot and pissed off, I see where the Nazis got the idea for meth from, but I think that If berserkers as a thing were really a thing, I don't know if it was methamphetamine or not. I think it was probably something a bit more potent and less synthetic than that. Another aspect of stories that you see about the berserkers, some scholars propose that the guys who were supposed to be berserkers on the battlefield were actually wearing animal skins over their chainmail as sort of like an indicator to the men on their own armies that they were just going to kill anyone near them without looking to see what side they were on. So, oh fuck, that's Bjorn. He's got the bear skin on. He's just fucking swinging. Be careful. You would think isn't really an effective way to fight a war, but, you know, I guess all these people died for a reason, right? Some theorize that, like I said, the berserkers were taking a hallucinogen of some sort, although many argue that that isn't likely. There is a plant called Hyoscyamus niger. It's also called black henbane, which is a lot easier to say. And it was discovered at a Viking gravesite in Denmark in 1977. And chemical tests on black henbane have shown that it causes symptoms very similar to those that are described as being displayed by the berserkers. And the shield biting and howling has also led some to theorize that berserkers were merely working themselves into a frenzy, which they called effect numer, which literally, I think, means numb to effects. Basically, you'd reach a hysterical state beyond physical emotion or physical feeling. There may be links between this and the wild man of the woods, like I said earlier, as these sort of hypermanic states and the ensuing PTSD following a giant battle may have just broken many soldiers psychologically. And then you had guys in wolf pelts wandering the woods. I mean, it seems reasonable enough to me. The medieval Irish, actually, also had a legend of a group of werewolves called the Werewolves of the Ossuary, and they appear in Norse mythology, actually. These werewolves were the descendants of Laenik Felud, whose line established the kings of Ossuary. these Irish werewolves bear some similarity to the berserkers in that they were believed to have probably just been warriors who donned wolf pelts in battle and carried on like animals. Wolves have actually been hunted to extinction in Ireland since the 17th century, partially due to conflations of werewolf attacks in medieval Ireland's countryside. They actually bred the Irish wolfhound specifically to hunt wolves, packs of which were allegedly attacking towns and killing small children. Before their extinction, wolves in Ireland were closely tied to nomadic warrior tribes called Fianna, men who lived in the wilderness because they had not inherited their land yet. And because they lived in the woods, Fianna's were often depicted as hairy and animalistic, naked or clad in animal skins. Some called them Lugtorna, or wolf skin. These warriors were said to go wolfing in battle, something loosely described like transforming into a wolf. This dates back to Lainic Feilid, who I mentioned earlier, and the Ossory Kings, the royal line of warriors, first described as taking what was called wolf shape in battle. The Ossories are the basis for the line of kings who ruled until the conquest of the Normans, and they're referred to in Irish histories as the descendants of the wolf. And the 14th century book, Book of Ballymote, A Middle Irish History of the World, beginning at the story of Noah's Ark, describes the Ossory kings of Ireland as being able to turn into wolves so that they could eat people. Spells related to attracting or repelling wolves were called Wolfsagen and Wolfsbann, respectively, in Bavarian folklore. These became prominent upon the association of werewolves and sorcery in the West. A wolfsagen was peddled by what were called wolf charmers. The charms prevented wolf attacks and were very popular until they were outlawed by the church. When the charms were declared to be sorcery, many wolf charmers were subsequently tried by the church as werewolves and witches both, actually. Wolf charmers were typically elderly men, and they're recorded as being tortured and executed for selling potions from the 1590s up to the 1650s. Although by the 17th century, they weren't being grouped with werewolves anymore. They were specifically witches and heretics. Moving on up in the world, I guess. In some places like Switzerland and the Netherlands, witches and werewolves were virtually interchangeable, particularly in the 16th century. And in fact, it's not until later that trials and persecution aimed explicitly at werewolves without reference to witches starts occurring. In 1595, Johann Steenhuisen confessed under torture, obviously, that he'd been working for the devil for 3 years as a werewolf. And then we have werewolf conflated with serial killer again with Gilles Garnier, or the Werewolf of Dole, right around this time as well. Several children in the Dole province of France had gone missing in the winter of 1572. Reports were that there was a werewolf in the area, and townspeople were authorized and encouraged to apprehend the werewolf and kill it, if possible. Shortly thereafter, someone chased what they believed to be a wolf with a child in its mouth, but was discovered to be Gilles Garnier. Upon interrogation, Garnier recounted a tale of being approached by a specter in the woods and offered a chance to receive powers that would transform him into a wolf at will and make it easier for him to hunt. Garnier then confessed to stalking, murdering, and eating at least 4 children in the form of a wolf, at least in his own mind, apparently. Garnier was then found guilty of lycanthropy and witchcraft, but somehow not cannibalism and murder, I guess, and then burned at the stake. It's noteworthy here that Garnier was executed for witchcraft and lycanthropy by the secular government and not by the Inquisition, because the Inquisition did not formally try cases of lycanthropy. They viewed lycanthropy as superstition. A rare case of the Catholic Inquisition having more sense than the government, apparently. So the Middle Ages were sort of the height of werewolf hysteria. People really saw, at least they believed they saw them, I should say, in fields attacking children and sheep. You wonder why they never intervened. They just kind of reported that they saw children being eaten. In Bordeaux, a teenager was actually given a life sentence for being a werewolf in 1603. Convictions and executions ran fairly steadily up until the late 17th century, when all of the sudden the general consensus seems to have shifted to the idea that turning into a wolf was probably a mental disorder of some kind. Starting in 1651, Diderot's encyclopedia attributed lycanthropy to a disorder of the brain. And it's very interesting, actually, that stories and reports of attacks in the woods and in fields that had been previously attributed to werewolves didn't stop happening. They just stopped being attributed to werewolves. This is really when sort of prototypical cryptids began appearing, and werewolves faded from secular attention just in time to finally reach the crosshairs of the church. Inexplicably, from 1649 to 1671, 9 church texts on lycanthropy were written in Rome, and executions for werewolfery are recorded in Bavaria as late as 1853. To put that into perspective, that is like a decade before we ended slavery in the United States. They were executing people for being werewolves in Bavaria. Beliefs about how one becomes a werewolf have really evolved quite a lot over the years. Biting didn't actually have anything to do with it until fairly recently. In some cases, as has been mentioned, the werewolf would don a belt, or perhaps a wolf skin, to become the wolf form. Other times, the werewolf would need a magic salve or potion of some kind. The Arabs and Turks believed that, this is fascinating, child abuse turned you into a werewolf, actually. The duration of the transformation is similarly varied and has been listed as an evening to years to permanently in some cases. The link between werewolves and witches is believed to be where the concept of animal familiars evolved from, as werewolves were often depicted as attending the witch's Sabbath. in some cases it was a curse, and is still associated with witchcraft and sorcery, albeit not from willing participants. At one point, the legend was that being excommunicated from the church turned you into a werewolf, but predominantly before the church, werewolves and therianthropy in general were associated with sorcery and magic. Cures for lycanthropy also vary rather widely, from exhaustion to death. Some prescribe exorcism. The ancient Arabs actually believed that one could be cured by striking them in the forehead with a knife. As you'd expect, this killed a lot of fucking people. Some herbal cures are also recommended, but these too are often fatally toxic. My advice is to just ride it out. I mean, we've all had bad trips, man. Like, I think if you've convinced yourself via a magic potion or weird jacket that you are a wolf that eats children, maybe just, like, lock yourself in a room and just ride it out, you know? If it's like the Berserker thing, maybe you just had too much coke and this is just the night you're gonna have, and you need to just, you know, not be around people, maybe listen to some Velvet Underground and just ride that wave. You know, sometimes that's the best you can really, that's the best you can really do in these cases. We're dealt the fucking hands we have, man. I don't know what to tell you. Right now you're a wolf and, you know, just ride it the fuck out. Cause I don't think you want to go to an exorcism, and you probably don't want flicked in the head with a knife. That seems painful. So, you know, just, rock the Thorazine and, I don't know, maybe put Sweet Nothing on repeat until you pass out. You'll be all right. I have faith in you. This motivational moment for werewolves brought to you by Moxie O'Brien of the Come and See podcast. Apparently, I have no idea where the fuck that came from. Anyway, back to the script. So I really think that it wouldn't be Come and See if we didn't tie this whole thing about werewolves somehow into racism, aliens, and the Nazis. And I believe I've got at least 2 out of 3, if not all 3, for you in today's episode. The Nazis were sort of low-key obsessed with werewolves, and wolves in general, really. Hitler's military HQ was actually dubbed the Wolf's Lair. I've been there, as a matter of fact. And let me tell you, if there is any evidence that that man was compensating for something on a military level, this bunker, holy fuck. I mean, we talked, I think, last season or the season before, maybe it was in the George Lincoln Rockwell episode, about the Eagle's Nest, the tea room that he had built into the side of a goddamn mountain that he almost never went to because he was afraid of heights. This was an underground base built out of, like, triple reinforced steel, with gun turrets built on either side of the walls every 2 steps going downward for like 7 stories, and then a machine gun turret aimed up at the top from the bottom, and then 2 more hanging from the ceiling. So you really have to ask yourself how the fuck we got in there in the first place, unless you're one of those people who think that we didn't really infiltrated at all until after he had already called for a ceasefire, and he evacuated and didn't actually kill himself, and he probably went to Argentina. I don't know. There are people out there who I've heard before think that's what really happened to Adolf Hitler. I'm not saying that I'm one of them, just that it's a thing that I may or may not have referenced several times that we'll probably do an episode about eventually. Anyway, The Wolf's Den is, like, cartoonishly fortified, and then the actual room itself where he and Ava Braun and his dog were supposed to have committed suicide or not, whatever, was, again, just like a giant iron fortress surrounded by gun turrets. So, the Wolf's Lair was, like, even as an unoccupied structure, like, intimidating to walk into. I can't imagine what it was like whenever there were actually people with guns in it. And he also, of course, had the Wehrmacht as a division of the SS, and the Wolfsangel, or Wolf's Hook, which was a medieval symbol which was based on a wolf trap that was adopted by the Panzer Division. It didn't stop there, though. Toward the end of the war, Hitler launched what he called his werewolf civilian militia initiative. The werewolf initiatives inspired two movements: an official group of Nazi paramilitaries, and the second, which was an honest-to-God German citizens militia that was organized via radio broadcasts. And, of course, the Werewolf Initiative is not to be confused with Operation Werewolf, which is a totally different thing from this guy who is apparently a genius, according to a whole bunch of people, but recycled the same name for like six different goddamn things, and a lot of his genius is based on stuff that we can't prove he actually ever actually did. But I digress. The Werewolf Initiative saw Nazi guerrillas knifing Allied soldiers who were off duty on leave away from bases. They set car bombs in Allied vehicles that were left unattended, and they sowed chaos as the Allies pushed further into Germany. The civilians would leave weapons and ammunition caches in the woods for Nazi troops as military supplies dwindled, and they would also report or sometimes murder their neighbors who housed Allied troops. And records show that at least six German mayors were assassinated by werewolves for cooperating with Allied forces. Radio broadcasts declaring, quote, "I am a savage. I am filled with rage. Lily the werewolf is my name. I bite. I eat. I am not tame. My werewolf teeth bite the enemy," end quote, were played all over Germany, urging citizens to be like the werewolf and bite the enemy. German newspapers printed headlines like "Nazi werewolves unleashed on invaders" and told stories of towns of German people driving out the invading Allies. Some of this was propaganda, obviously, but some of it wasn't. U.S. military intelligence reports suggest that the Nazi werewolf organization, as they referred to it, was significantly demoralizing to troops at the end of the war, and that gangs of teenagers posting werewolf insignia were sabotaging Allied vehicles and killing soldiers found alone at night. Two such teenagers, Heinz Petri and Josef Schroner, were actually executed by firing squad for espionage by the U.S. military in June of 1945. Civilian terrorism from the werewolves continued until 1947, and is estimated to have resulted in thousands of casualties over a two-year period. After all, we're far too familiar in this country with what a handful of teenage Nazis are capable of in short bursts. It's believed that the Nazi werewolves may have served as inspiration for insurgent groups like ISIS, and of course, we know what they've inspired here. Leaderless resistance traces back to this fairly neatly, as was popularized by Klansman and LibertyNet founder Louis Beam. Werewolves are often depicted as savage and animalistic in nature, but the werewolf actually served as the primary inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula, which would reinvent the vampire for the 20th century. Here we also see again werewolf traits ascribed to a Jewish coded villain character in the vampire Count Dracula. The idea that vampires are allergic to silver comes from werewolves in Germanic folklore of the 19th century, but that actually traces to shapeshifter lore in the 17th century. According to stories, hitting a shapeshifter in the forehead with a silver button turned the shapeshifter into two ill-favored old ladies. So put that in your back pocket. The modern conception of the werewolf, often as animalistic, primitive, subservient, has really evolved along with who typically portrays them in TV and film. It's been said by Bram Stoker that his character of Dracula, who was again based on the characterization of the werewolf, was sort of a parallel for the Victorian patriarchy. And in keeping with the idea of the vampire as a foil for the werewolf representing patriarchy, modern films, particularly up through the 1970s, really use werewolves as kind of a symbol for men's animalistic nature, and oftentimes are depicted as sexual predators, rapists, cannibals, things of that sort. And starting with whatever the fuck year it came out, Twilight flat out portrayed werewolves as a Native American tribe. The trend of portraying werewolves as non-white people has really become something of a trope in the genre in the last several years. And this is another one of those problematic things where this thing that has never really been specifically ascribed to any non-white group of people, really, because they didn't have wolves, for example, all of the sudden, well, not in the case of the natives necessarily, obviously there were North American wolves, but this thing that was never specifically associated with that group of people has now come to associate these animalistic, subservient, savage, etc. tropes with something that is now almost exclusively portrayed by non-white people after having been associated with, much like Dracula, in films like An American Werewolf in London and things like that, more upper to upper middle class white men, as opposed to tribes of African or indigenous people, which is what you see more often than not now. And especially in how werewolves are often portrayed as a slave class in fantasy, subservient to be it vampires or witches or another group of supernatural creatures, you see a lot of latent racism come out in the depictions of werewolves. So it's interesting how this thing that was sort of in the ancient Greeks kind of like a precursor to blood libel in a way, in hey, so there's a lot of children missing and things of that nature, let's blame it on this guy and say that he did it and torture him until he agrees with us, and how it's had these sort of negative social connotations for such a long time, and how in the modern era, that has evolved from kind of a Jewish-coded thing, parallel to blood libel, to almost a way for white people to portray non-white people as primitive and tribalistic in fantasy nowadays. And in that way, the evolution of the portrayal of the savage raping beast into what is now typically black and brown people is sort of something that I think needs to be looked at and perhaps deconstructed, because we've always, particularly in fantasy, science fiction, anything that has the portrayal of non-human but speaking characters a lot of the time, ascribe black voices, brown voices, non-white coded characters to non-human, animal, ape-like, dog-like, lizard-like creatures. You know, we're going to get deeper into that a bit whenever we discuss vampires the week of Halloween, and how a lot of the conception of vampires, much like the conception of werewolves, has a lot to do with anti-Semitism. And it's interesting how much of folkloric monster, folkloric legends about creatures and things that go bump in the night and kidnap your children was really just Europeans, whether it was the Greeks or the Holy Roman Empire and the church, finding ways to describe people that they wanted to demonize as behaving like beasts that needed to be tamed by foreign intervention. And that's something that we saw with the way the Romans and the church conceptualized the Celts and paganism and the Druids, if they were real, which I don't think they were. We see it in how the berserkers are portrayed in other cultural conception, and how they were recontextualized as blood drinkers by the Catholic Church. So there's a tendency with colonialism, with foreign invasion, and the destruction of cultures a lot of the time, particularly, I think we'll see once we start talking about the doctrine of discovery next season, and the exportation of a particular socio-religious cultural practice, where in order to justify what quote-unquote needs to be done to terraform a group of people and all of their cultural practices and beliefs and traditions and histories to what you want them to be, what you deem them correct, requires you to rewrite and revise what they are and what they believe and what their practices may or may not be in such a way that they can be demonized, they can be othered, they are less than what we are offering them by coming in here and taking their culture away. And I think that the werewolf thing, albeit presumably unintentionally, becomes representative of that, because in the way they're portrayed in fantasy as a lot of the time lesser working class mindless beasts, savages, bloodthirsty, primitive, etc., and how they are now used as sort of an analog for groups of tribal cultures, you see how Europeans conceive of those cultures as primitive, in need of being overseen, whether it's by vampires, witches, the Catholic Church, or whoever. And it's interesting to look at that parallel. I think that in many cases, fantasy and science fiction offers that sort of unintentional lens into social structure, in that a lot of the time the white guys writing it don't even realize, well, I guess in the case of the fantasy stuff, white women, even as often as white men, don't realize that the message that they are implanting into the literature that they're writing, and that is that, ah, well, of course the not white people would, you know, behave like animals and need someone to make sure that they're civilized, and perhaps there's a sort of a parental aspect to the whole thing, and there's a weird infantilization of the obviously savage non-white group, and how isn't that just kind of how Europeans have portrayed non-white people in everything forever and ever, amen. And actually, to extrapolate that a little bit further, you know, I mentioned a little bit ago that werewolves, particularly in cinema throughout the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, became sort of a portrayal, and this also traces to Bram Stoker and his conceptualization of Dracula as this creature, this sort of vaguely sexual creature, having a being a representation of patriarchy, a representation of male primitive energy, a representation of sort of that savage sexual nature of a lot of men, and in that way, like I said, a lot of werewolves are portrayed as rapists, sexual predators, stalking women, etc. You can look at that movie The Wolfman, a lot of different films. There is a sexual component to the aspect of the werewolf, right? Well, when you put that lens on non-white characters, you really change the particularly historical conception, and I want you to follow me here for a second. Those of you who've listened to the show before or have gone back and listened to some of the older episodes or are familiar with some of what we talked about in the Four-Cornered Room, you're familiar with the first wave of feminism in particular, in how leading up to Prohibition, the way a lot of Native, Indigenous American, and Black both freedmen and slaves were portrayed as roving sexual predators who preyed upon prairie wives, who needed to be lynched to be kept in place because they were preying on the sacred womanhood of the turn of the century white woman, and how this idea, and the same was used. It was used as an argument for why we needed to further police Black men and brown men. It was used as an argument in favor of prohibition, in that alcohol turned Black men and brown men into savage beasts who raped white women. It was used in the argument for why cannabis needed to be illegal, because smoking pot made Black and brown men behave like savage beasts who sexually assaulted white women. And there is a history in the United States in particular of whenever someone needs something to be accomplished on a social level, two of the easiest fear buttons to push are children and white womanhood. And we really get the idea of children and family as an idea for fear mongering from white women being put in charge of campaigns for things like the Ku Klux Klan. But the idea of weaponizing the need to protect white women as a means to attack non-white men has a historical precedence that goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So whenever you start applying this character that has a precedence in media as being representative of this savage sexual predator and beast, and apply that to only non-white male characters, I feel like you're sending a conscious or subconscious message. And it's probably worth noting that a lot of the same media that does this, ascribe the werewolf character to a non-white man, it's usually in the form of a love interest. And a love interest that is portrayed as exotic. And we see this in the way that a lot of literature and entertainment geared toward white women fetishizes non-white men. And there's a parallel to that in the way werewolves are portrayed in fantasy that I think is alarming because of the bestiality aspect of it, of course. But it's worth noting, I think, that there is a tendency to fetishize black and brown men sexually that sort of transfers into this, you know, savage, animalistic, sexual creature that is now almost exclusively portrayed by black guys and brown guys. So there's, and of course, the same can be said for how black and brown women are portrayed as sexual beings, less intelligent, less of less agency, subservient, but also, you know, real good in the sack kind of a thing, as they've been portrayed in white media for decades and decades and decades. So there's something to be said of the parallel in the sexualization of non-white bodies and the sexual nature inherent in the modern portrayal of the werewolf, and how these two things now intersect constantly in that medium. I also think it's noteworthy that the black or brown male characters in these turn into a dog. I think that there's something to be said in, especially in the way that in a lot of sexual circumstances, sexual dynamics between white AFAB characters and non-white AMAB characters, the dynamic is as such that you are a sexual tool there to be used, but you are also not at the same level as the one using the tool. And the portrayal of the character as a dog, in a way, really sort of, I think, is representative of that. And the last thing that I think is necessary to point out about this vampire werewolf tangent that I was sort of on earlier about how Dracula is derived from werewolves is that in this we see another way that if the werewolf is a parallel for black and brown characters, the vampire, who is traditionally white or European or Slavic, either way, it's typically a white character, who derived all of its characteristics from the vampire, from the werewolf, who is now identified as working class or primitive or savage or non-white, typically. You see in the vampire almost a form of cultural appropriation, in that vampires get to maintain this level of regality, royalty, they're fancy, they're Victorian, they're usually, in many cases, portrayed as being in charge of the werewolf population in the conception of whatever fantasy or horror you may happen to be reading. But as a group that has, in the 20th century conception of vampire, stolen its entire identity from werewolves, for werewolves to now be portrayed almost exclusively as non-white, savage beasts, says a lot about what Europeans think about racial and power dynamics. Probably not on purpose, but still probably worth pointing out. And that's all I got for you today about werewolves, listeners. I think that this is not entirely a closed conversation, because we're going to continue this with Wednesday's episode as well. So while we have put sort of a paperclip in the werewolf portion of the Therianthrope conversation for the week, we're not quite done. There is more to come. But we will be back, same Mox time, same Mox channel. On Wednesday, we're going to continue things by discussing Skinwalkers and the Skinwalker Ranch. I toyed with the idea of making all of that one episode and doing all of it together, but I really think once you tie the Skinwalker Ranch into things, there's way too fucking much stuff to get all of it in one episode. So I thought, rather than trying to cram all of that together and explain kind of the relationship between skinwalkers and werewolves, I would just do them as two separate episodes in the same week that have a connection to one another. So on Wednesday, we're going to talk about skinwalkers. And I said that it wouldn't be a come and see episode if I didn't find a way to tie it into, like, racism, Nazis, and UFOs. Well, we're also going to tie it into UFOs with the Skinwalker Ranch. So we're going to get weird, but we're also kind of still talking about kind of sort of werewolves, but not really werewolves, more like coyotes. And also kind of sort of witch doctors, but not really witch doctors. It's a lot. See, this is why I didn't want to do it all as one episode. It takes more than 5 minutes to explain all of this shit, so we're just going to do it on Wednesday, and you can hear me do all of that then. I know that this is coming out on Tuesday, and Wednesday is tomorrow, but that's okay. We're just gonna let it fucking, we'll do it live. I have the clip, but I'm not gonna, you've heard it already. I don't like to recycle. And that's why I wasn't good at comedy. I never did any bits more than like two times. But anyway, that's what we have in store for the week. And then I think on Friday, we're going to do Bigfoot. I know we've sort of held off on Sasquatch, Bigfoot, or as I like to call it, the North American Great Ape, so far on the show. And we haven't really done much with cryptids other than living dinosaurs in Mokele Mbembe last season, which ended up actually being more about young Earth Christianity than it did about dinosaurs. I'm still kind of disappointed about that, but I did find out that I knew the guy who wrote the book, or his grandkids anyway, got high in my old basement, so that's weird. So we're gonna do Bigfoot on Friday, I think. It's not really directly tied into werewolves, but they're both hairy, so in my mind it's kind of the same thing. It really is that much of a connection, I'm not exaggerating. Anyway, that's what we've got for the week, and then I think we've got one more week until we do the big Halloween stuff for the last week of spooky season. So we got two more weeks left and two more episodes left this week, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I have no idea why I said that. Anyway, in the meantime, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. And drink more water or whatever. But I have been Moxie O'Brien, as far as I know anyway. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
Finished.